All right, thanks everybody for being here. I'm really interested in how tonight goes. I've kind of got some ideas, and we're going to play a little bit by ear and see how the conversation goes and whatnot. Just to kind of set your expectations, we'll go till about 8 or so and take a break, and then we'll go again, and we'll make sure to stop right at 9. There are some snacks to kind of keep your blood sugar up while we're, you know, while we're talking. Grab some. Get up whenever you want or during the break. The first part of tonight is going to be a little more working through some material, and the second half is going to be a little more some conversations around our tables and trying to process some stuff together. This is a URL that I'd love for you to visit at some point tonight, if you will. It's a survey. Part of the idea behind what we're doing tonight is that to start thinking about this more and see what we can offer as a church to the Bay Area. So, you know, this is a long history, but I think one of the things we're realizing at PBC is that we have a particular place in the world, and God has put us here, and we're kind of asking what can we do well here in our particular place. And we like talking and listening and learning. We're kind of academically oriented. So is there some way that we can here contribute towards kind of the whole tech industry from a theological perspective with some training or some discipleship or classes or something along those lines? So we're just trying to think a little bit broadly about that. And we're actually in conversations with Regent College, which is a seminary up in Vancouver, British Columbia, the possibility of partnering with them to do some either classes or curriculum or conferences here locally. So partly, I'd love to get feedback on what would actually be compelling for people to come to. You know, we would want to offer stuff that people would be interested in. So this is a little survey, tinyurl.com/techtheo for technology, theology. There's an alternate version that Ray discovered that hacks your phone. So ask him for the misspelling one that bricks your iPhone. But this one should not hack your phone. This one should be okay. So it's just a little survey, you know, some thoughts. And there's a couple of questions on there, too, about some possible follow-up things. There's a Christian hackathon that's happening later on, if anybody's interested, to get some feedback if anybody's interested in things like that. Actually, this is Jake. Would you say hi? This is Jake Duckworth. Jake is the pastor over at the church down on the corner, Crossroads Community Church, not Crossworld. And his church is doing something really cool where they're trying to host a... Why don't you explain it?
Yeah, sure. Most of you maybe have already seen co-working spaces, just places where entrepreneurs will get together, or they'll bring their small companies into places to just work in proximity. If they're doing an entrepreneur, a startup kind of thing, often there are times when they lack community or need a place to network or need to share resources. And so we're trying to start a space where entrepreneurs can be together and move their businesses forward, but in such a way that their faith is also integrally connected to the work that they're doing. And so there will be discipleship along the way and opportunities to have pastoral presence and pray over their businesses or big decisions they're making. And then, of course, they can network with one another and make use of one another's talents and gifts. And so along those lines, it's still very much becoming what it will be. So that's about as generally as I can describe it.
Cool, thanks. So there's a question on the survey about if that's of interest to you, too, then I can pass people on to Jake and the people that are working on that. Okay, so this is we're going to be doing kind of some thinking at the front end of this, as I said, and we're going to be thinking about these big questions that we have about technology and theology, and what does the Bible have to say about technology. The thing that is compelling to me, and what has kind of been on my heart that has led me here, is just realizing how much rapid change is happening in our culture and our society. And everybody's aware of this. Everybody knows that things are changing quickly. There's new technology. Everything's moving fast. And people are both creating technology and using technology without a lot of relevant reflection on what that means in terms of the kingdom of God. And so this is not to say we should not be creating or using technology. This is not an anti-technology at all kind of thinking, but it's, are there values? Are there principles? Is there something about how the kingdom of God works that could inform how we both use and create technology well? And because things are moving so fast, there's almost not even space to do that. And so how can we do that better? That's my goal here tonight. Hopefully this is the beginning of something where we can be thinking about that well, and I'd love to be contributing that to what's going on in the Bay Area as a church and for us to be engaged in that. So another one of the questions on the survey is whether you're interested in being part of some sort of kind of learning cohort or something to be exploring these issues. Because this is not just, come listen to a talk and then you got it figured out kind of thing. And on that note, that reminds me to say that, to remind you, or if it wasn't already clear, that I don't have anything figured out. And that I don't have any answers, and that basically what I've done is kind of a little bit of thinking, a little bit of reading, combined with a little bit of scripture, put some stuff together, and this is very much in the mindset of, like, we're just going to go into some ideas and see what comes of it. And this is a little bit different for me. I tend to usually start things where I have some idea of where they'll end, and with this particular thing that I'm kind of been thinking about, I'm pretty convinced that having some theological reflection would help creating and using technology, but I don't know how yet. Does that make sense? I don't know what the application is. You know, I think that if we are to, and what we'll do tonight at the front here is to think biblically about how technology has been used and created in the Bible. And I think doing that will help us, but I don't have kind of your five application points for you to go off and implement. This is very much, let's think about this together. So that's a lot of caveats before we begin. There are some books that have informed what I'm talking about tonight. This is one, iGods by Detweiler. The one that probably has helped me the most biblically is a book called From the Garden to the City. It's by a guy named John Dyer. He was actually a classmate of mine in seminary. And then there's also a book called The Next Story by Tim Challies. But I was surprised at how little work there is in this area, how little people are doing this kind of work. There's a lot of people that, like, rant against technology, right? Or a lot of people that say, you know, Facebook is bad because of this and it's ruining our culture. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. But to think critically about how technology and the person of God kind of inform each other, there's a little bit of that. So what we're going to do, three things tonight. First, we're going to think a little bit about history of technology as a whole, kind of over the last 500 years or so, take a big swath. Then we're going to look at a biblical history of theology and talk, kind of walk through a few categories in the Bible. And I'm hoping to do those two things before we break. And then when we come back after our break, we'll be talking more specifically about technology today and theology for us, and we'll be talking in small groups and kind of bringing that together, and that part will be a little more interactive. All right? Sound good? So, if you have a Bible, you can open it to Genesis. We're going to spend a little bit of time in Genesis. And we're going to do a little bit of a history of theology to start. The first verse I want to read is Genesis 1:28, and we're going to have a couple verses that frame our thinking on this. This is a verse that we talked about a lot when we did our series on vocation. It's a idea that just kind of thinking biblically, theologically informs a lot of how you read the rest of the Bible. And that's Genesis 1:28. God said to them, this is of course after he created Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So, if you think about that as the first instruction that God gave to his creation, then you can think that God basically created people with two purposes. And we talked about this again in vocation, but just to refresh our memory a little bit, you might think that God created his creatures and instructed them to both create and to control. Okay? So if you look at that verse again, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." That's a creative function. You are to fill the earth. And I think this refers to both procreation, you know, having children and filling the earth with people, but also filling the earth with life and filling the earth with stuff. It's a creative activity. but also subdue it and have dominion over it. So there's a controlling aspect because, well, if you've been in my house, you know the more life you create, the more you have to control it. Or things get out of control, right? So those two things kind of go together. You have to create and control to kind of maintain some level of normalcy in the world. So this can be thought of as kind of God's purpose that he's given us. We create and we control. And it's no accident, of course, that we see God doing those very things in Genesis as well, right? God is a creator, and God, in some sense, sets boundaries upon his creation. He has dominion over, and he rules over his creation. And so God is one who creates and controls. He creates us in his image so that we create and control. Good so far? Okay, here's where it gets a little bit tricky. Now we're going to think a little bit about the history of technology. All right, so let's open this up. I'm going to suggest a definition for technology, but who wants to try and beat my definition before I tell you? Who wants to define technology for us? Yeah, Aaron.
Inventions that extend the capabilities of humans.
Okay, that's good. I like that. That's pretty close to mine. You've been reading on this, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've been reading the same books. Christine, yeah.
Modification of basic elements or whatever is already in the world in order to serve mankind or the world.
Okay, good, yeah. Modifications of kind of stuff, right? Like raw materials to serve mankind. Anybody else? Okay, we'll go something along those lines. Here's my suggestion. Pretty much along those lines. Although both of your suggestions were very much focused on things, right? Inventions that are like objects, but technology can actually be abstractions as well, which is a hint for some of the stuff we'll see biblically. But here's a phrase that was in one of the books I read that I think is a helpful way just to guide us. Technology is the creative activity of using tools to shape God's creation for practical purposes. Okay? Creative activity, so technology itself, and this is one of the kind of linguistic curiosities, is that technology can be a thing, you know, this pen is technology, but technology can also be the process of creating technology. It can be the process of creating pens, right? So you have to kind of specify what you're thinking about. But technology is the creative activity of using tools to shape God's creation for practical purposes. And I do like the element that both Aaron and Christine added, that there's some aspect to where technology extends our natural abilities. It takes what we can already do, but in general we can do it better. Does that make sense? Okay. So if that's the case, then let's think about eras of technology and think a little bit about what's happened over the last, actually would be about 400 years. So middle of the 16th century or so was the beginning, was when kind of the Industrial Revolution was kicking off. And so what was the technology that was happening in the middle of the 16th century? Yeah, Dave.
I'm not sure exactly when the middle of the 16th century was, but the printing press.
Okay. That was a little bit earlier. Yep. But yeah, that was part of the same general trend. So the printing press, what else is being invented? I mean, this is kind of 15th, 16th, 17th century, somewhere in there.
Gunpowder?
Probably. I can't verify that. What's that?
Steam power.
What's that?
Balloons.
Looms, yeah, yeah. Steam power, which would power machines.
Automated
manufacturing. Yeah, so that was kind of the big one. There was using steam, and if you've heard the term Luddite, right? If you know this term, it's people that don't use iPhones, right? Flip phone people. That's how we know them. But in this era, Luddites were a group of people who were responding negatively towards essentially automated manufacturing, so looms and stuff like this, and they were kind of led by this. Most people think he's a mythical figure, General Ned Ludd, who probably didn't really exist because he lived in Sherwood Forest and nobody ever saw him. But they would raid manufacturing facilities and destroy their machines because they thought machines were taking jobs. So much so that England actually made it a capital offense to destroy machinery in response to this kind of growing trend of the Luddites. So if you think of this, this is kind of the first era of technology was machines that made doing things easier or better. And in a sense, it was giving people more power, right? I mean, I can sew a shirt, but a loom can sew lots of shirts a lot faster, that kind of thing, all right? So that's kind of roughly this Industrial Revolution era of technology. Let's jump ahead a couple hundred years and think maybe middle of the 19th century, 1850 or so, what new technology came that was of a different category?
Telegraph and telephone.
Thank you. Telegraph, telephone. So now you have this whole new category of communication technology, right? Yeah, Randy.
I would add transportation to that as well.
Transportation as well. And they kind of fit in the same category. If this, if we think of the first Industrial Revolution kind of machinery as increasing people's power, we might think of this second category as increasing people's presence, right? So now you could be places that you couldn't have gotten to as easily before, either by traveling there quickly or by telegraphing messages. And so you were able to be present with people in a much different manner than you were before this. And of course, this led to the whole kind of industry of telegraph, telephone, computer, et cetera, kind of that just accelerated into the various types of communication technology. All right, so then let's jump ahead 100 years. Again, 1950 or so, we're more familiar with this. What kind of technology era began then that we're still pretty much in?
Transistor,
what's that?
You jumped past the airplane.
I did jump past the airplane. We didn't just lump that in with vehicles and stuff. It's a broad overlook. Yeah, Carl.
Radio became television.
Uh-huh. Radio, television, all these kind of ways of
radio first.
Being places, right.
World wars.
A lot of wars in there, for sure. So
silicon, semiconductors.
Yeah, semiconductors. And the thing that then could happen there is you know, if the first era was power, was doing physical things, and then it was presence, now it had to do with information, right? Information could be processed, information could be stored, information could be transmitted. Now we're in the kind of couple generations of inheriting this where we have big data. We have so much information about things, about what's happened. We don't even know what to do with it, right? How do you process the fact that I know my heart rate every minute of my last night's sleep? That should be helpful, right? I should be able to do something good with that data, but what? Right? So there's this massive amounts of information that we have. And so think about that. If the first era gave us more power, the second era gave us more presence, now we have more knowledge, right? But let's think about those categories for a minute. Do those categories sound familiar at all? Anybody? Any classical theologians in the room? What are the three classical qualities that you would attribute to God? What makes God God?
Omnipotence.
Omnipresence.
Omniscience.
So God is God because he has unlimited power. He can be everywhere and he knows everything. That's essentially what makes God God. So just a really brief historical overview of the last 400 years, we realize we're getting closer. Maybe, right? If he's infinite, then we're not actually getting closer because you can keep adding one and you're still the same distance away. But this is the challenge, right? Is that now this isn't all bad, I want to suggest, because God told us to do the things that he does, right? God is a creator and a controller. And he gave that charge to us to say we ought to go and create and control. And so it makes sense that to do that well, we need to be powerful, we need to be present, we need to be knowledgeable. And so increasing those capabilities makes us do that better. But at what point are we trying to represent God better? And at what point does that morph into trying to replace God? And that's, I think, the tension that we have in thinking about technology is our technology extends our natural abilities. It helps us to do what God's asked us to do. In a sense, it gets us closer to God, but it can also be a way that we take God's place. And it can be us trying to become like God, which is also the first sin, right? So there's no easy answers here, right? It's not wrong to want to be more powerful, but we don't want to replace God. Yeah, a few thoughts. What do you think, Dave?
When I was a kid, my mother got a magazine called Wisdom Magazine. And we talked about the difference between intelligence and wisdom.
Mm.
And for decades, since the 50s, the term artificial intelligence has been bandied about. But I've never heard the term artificial wisdom.
Interesting.
And that's something God has that I don't see technology encroaching on.
I don't know, maybe somebody will build an app after tonight. No? You just let it go. I mean...
You have the right...
No non-disclosure agreements here. Okay. Any other thoughts, any other just reactions to those ideas? Yeah, Christine.
So it seems like for Western civilization, at least, there were more believers than non-believers for a very long time.
Mm.
And now it's swung the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does feel like this push toward being God is what is kind of driving the culture away from God.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And you can get in a little bit of a chicken and the egg question too, right?
Yeah.
Which came first? Any other thoughts? All right, well, let's jump forward. So that's kind of a little bit of an intro historically. Now what I want to do is walk through some biblical passages and think critically about technology in the Bible. All right, we're going to walk through a bunch of different stories and think about how technology functions. Okay, we're going to start with... actually, let me give you one more guiding thing. So if we take Genesis 1, this idea of creating and controlling... If we think about that as the purpose that God gave his creation, I want to anchor us in another verse to think about how we are to fulfill that purpose. And this is Matthew 22, 37 to 39, which some of you might recognize as one of the references to the greatest commandment. This is Jesus speaking, and he said to them, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." So I want to suggest that with these two grounding passages, we have a bit of a framework for thinking about just human activity in the world. So if Genesis 1 gives us our purpose, which is to create and control, then Matthew 22 and the other similar passages give us our guiding biblical ethic. This is how we are to do what God has asked us to do. Does that make sense? So if our purpose is to create and control, then the way we do that, or the manner in which we do that, or the boundaries which guides those activities, is that we do that in a way that loves God and loves people. So that if we create in a way that distances ourselves from God or hurts people, we are fulfilling our purpose in an unethical way, if we create and control in a way that honors God, and loves people, then we are both fulfilling our purpose, but we're doing it the way God wants us to as well. So I think that we're going to kind of use those tonight as we think, because I think those can be helpful, just grounding frameworks for what we do and how we do it. Does that make sense? Any questions there? Feel free to interrupt, ask questions, raise your hands. As I said, I don't really know what I'm talking about, so feedback is very welcome. So as we go through the Bible looking at technology, for the sake of simplifying it, I'm gonna narrow it down to one kind of technology, which tends to be one of the most powerful kinds of technology, and at least in our culture, in our kind of common contemporary era, is one of the forms that is the most prevalent and is driving a lot of change, and that is communication technology, and in particular, mediated communication. So we're going to be looking through the Bible at the examples of mediated communication. Does anybody feel like they want to take a, a stab at explaining what mediated communication is?
Well, if you shorten it, it's media.
Media, yeah, okay. What's a medium?
It's a ghost.
A ghost, that's right.
Something in between.
Something in between. Thank you, CJ. Yeah, medium is something that goes in between, right? It's not small or large. It's medium, right? So a medium is something that connects two entities. It's something that connects that distance, that crosses that chasm, right? And so communication that's mediated is one person communicating to another person, and there's something that is managing that gap, okay? So it could be a telegraph, could be a telephone, could be a computer, could be all sorts of things. But it's some type of communication that's mediated. So this will make more sense to you as we start talking in the Bible. So we're going to jump into Genesis again. And here is the question of the day, all right? What is the first technology in the Bible?
Tablet.
Say again?
Tablet.
Tablet? Tablet is definitely a technology in the Bible. We'll get to there, but it's not the first.
The gates of Eden.
The gates of Eden. Okay, that's a good technology. I think there's one earlier. Randy?
I'm not sure when fire gets mentioned. But
fire does get mentioned.
It doesn't seem like it's in Genesis.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know when our first...
Light.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's pretty early. Light's pretty early. That's good. You're like, what's the second verse? All right. The earth. Light, I hadn't thought of a technology, so we're going to skip over that one. What do you think?
Okay. I'm saying God's word, it's like a problem.
God's word, that's true, yeah. That one's a little more arguable. Yeah, I like that. God created, he spoke, so his voice, that's a good one.
I would say creation of space-time.
Creation of space and time, okay. Could be a technology.
Technology.
We're getting more and more abstract, I like this.
Clothing when they sew the fig leaves.
Okay, clothing. We're definitely going to talk about clothing, but I think there's one significant one before clothing. Apple, yeah. No. Fair enough. The forbidden apple. That's true.
Yeah, that's just
naming, okay. This one, all right. Explain yourself, Darren.
One of the, before God even created Eve, he told Adam, you know, here's all the animals. Name them, give them names.
Yes.
And it's actually something that people do when they're working with things. They give them names so that they can stop referring, oh, that round thing over there, no, not that round thing, the other round thing.
Right,
You give things names so that you can...
Thank you. So language, right? So the first technology in the Bible is language. And, you know, maybe God's voice, I mean, for the purposes of how I'm thinking about it, we're going to say it's first, but one of the first. How about that? Then we can caveat it. Language. So if language is the first technology, and this is, it's not a thing, but it is a tool, as Darren pointed out, that extends our natural capabilities, right? We could silently probably do something together, and we could point and grunt, but like language helps us to extend our capabilities. So a couple of the interesting things about language, then, is that, whose idea was it?
God's.
So God commanded Adam to create the first technology. All right? So all your friends that have flip phones, you can say, you really should get an iPhone because God loves technology, right? He commanded the first technology. All right? So the first technology was commanded by God. And what it does is it helps communication, but it helps communication in a mediated way. Right? So when I say... I rode a horse yesterday, which I didn't, but if I did, I would say, I rode a horse yesterday. All of you now, most of you, have in your mind a picture of me on top of something that is roughly horse-like, right? And so whatever experience I had yesterday has now been transferred to you, and you think you know what I did. Could be, of course, I was riding, those things that you build with, right? Aren't those called horses, too?
Sawhorse,
right. I could have been on a sawhorse. So all of you could be completely wrong. So that would be a breakdown in the mediated communication.
Or the one in front of the store that you stick a cord in.
That's right, exactly. So you really have no idea what I did. But this experience has been transferred to you in some mediated way. We did this with our infant daughter when, you know, our first baby. I think this is common for first babies. Those of your parents, you teach them these sign language words, right? So there's like more and what did we have? Eat, milk, thank you, yeah, please. It was great because you only teach them the things you want them to be able to say, which is like fantastic season of parenting, right? The only communication available to them are like five words, and none of them are no.
Why?
Exactly, or why. Exactly. Like, when they started learning all the words, then things got complicated. But so this is a way of enhancing our capabilities, right? Language helped us to communicate. So this is something commanded by God. Adam did it and named all the animals. And this is, I think, probably kind of indicative of or, you know, the birth of language in general. Because if you, what do you do the first, you know, if you meet someone who speaks another language and you have nothing in common, the first thing you do is be like, chair, right? I mean, you kind of start with objects. And somebody else says it in their language.
Food,
yeah, apple. You kind of start with things. And so this is what Adam is doing. He's creating language. All right, so that's the first technology. God commanded it. It was good. And one other thing, this, one of the purposes of language, if you think back to my example of I rode a horse yesterday, one of the purposes of language, anyway, is for me to reveal myself to you. Right? So apart from language, or maybe some later technology, you would have a really hard time understanding what I did yesterday. You know, if I just had to like mime it out, like, yesterday, it'd be really hard. So language helps you to know me. It helps me to reveal myself to you, which if we go back to our ethic, to love God and love people, certainly one of the foundations of love is to know each other. So language as a technology has the capability to enable that or to extend that. We're going to come back to that in a minute. It's also interesting to note, what is one of the worst examples of technology in the Old Testament? The technology gone awry story in the Old Testament. The Tower of Babel, thank you. The Tower of Babel was exactly people trying to, as we said earlier, replace God rather than represent God. And what was the punishment for the Tower of Babel?
More language.
Scatter, but first, he confused their languages. So because they misused technology, the punishment was to take away the most basic technology they had. Right? Now again, I don't know what any of this means. I just think those are really interesting observations. And if we reflect on these kinds of things, something good's going to come of this.
Cain communicated using a rock.
Cain communicated. That was very clear, direct communication. Rocks have that capability. All right, so that's enough for language. Let's go on. Second kind of, yeah, Christine.
I have to go back, and maybe I should have said this sooner.
That's okay.
You started with this idea of mediated communication.
Okay.
When you said that, I thought of mediation as a person in between two people.
Okay.
And so when I said shortened media, what I meant was like newspapers
sure.
are mediated communication because they're seeing the story or hearing the story or researching the story, and they're communicating it to us.
Right.
Right? So we get the story from them. They are the mediators.
Right.
Right? So but just now you were talking about like two people talking to each other and it being mediated. But
well,
I don't see that as mediated because...
So language is actually a type of media. So language itself
is doing the
mediation. And that's why it's not a perfect mediator, right? Because I could say I rode a horse and you could have a completely false conception of what I actually did. So the mediation could be a thing or a person, but it could also be kind of
just the
language itself. Yeah. And then we'll get that'll play itself out a little bit more later too. Okay, so that's the first one. What's one of the next ones? I'm going to stop being absolute here, but somebody already mentioned it. Nope. Clothing. Okay, so this is interesting, right? Genesis 3, God's creation rebels against him, does the one thing they're not supposed to do, and what is their first reaction was to
hide,
to cover themselves. So their first reaction was to become entrepreneurs, right? Was to have a clothing startup. So they created technology in response to their failure, right? So Genesis 3, verse 7, then the eyes of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. That verse is basically the model for business plans, right? The eyes of them were opened. Like, you see the problem, right? I see. We're naked. This thing, this problem exists. So they sewed fig leaves. So let's make a product and let's use it, right? This is what we do. This is the technological process. You see a problem, you make a product, product solves your problem. So the second piece of technology is clothing itself. So why, what's wrong with this technology then?
We can't know you as well.
We can't know you as well, right. That might be a good thing, it might be a bad, you know. Some of us don't want to be known that well, and that's okay. Yeah. So, yeah, Jake.
It doesn't deal with the problem of the day either.
Right, yeah. So they're solving a different problem than the real problem. That's
solving
a really good
symptom.
They're solving a symptom of the problem. Yeah, I like that. That's a good way of saying it. Yeah, so they're... if language... Now, I didn't actually point this out. Language can also be used to obscure myself from another person, right? But if language can be used to reveal myself to another person, clothing is a tool to hide behind, right? To cover my shame. Doesn't actually deal with that. But this technology, now at least the intent behind it, we actually know why they created it. We're told why they created this technology. The intent was to hide, was to cover, was to obscure myself from another person. Now this is interesting. I had this, and clothing is a fascinating thing to think about as technology, because it absolutely is a technology, and clothing itself, I'm not particularly interested in fashion or clothing trends or anything, but it's just interesting to think about how those affect people and communities. And so I had an interesting conversation with two of my children, talking about whether their school should have uniforms. And one of them was very affected by the fact that different people chose to wear different clothing and how that created different categories and groups. And this one of my children was saying, it'd just be great if everybody could wear the same thing. And we never had to worry about what I was wearing, what the other person was wearing. And one of my other kids was saying, but that's boring. You know, I want to wear what I want to wear, and I want to be able to wear the things I like to wear. And so there's a very interesting discussion about technology as either a way to equalize communities or as a way to self-express. And those values, you know, you could probably see some value in each of those values, and yet how do you make those kinds of decisions? So the first technology was God's idea, and it was primarily created in order to reveal one person to another. The second technology was man's idea, and it was primarily created to conceal from another. But there's something really surprising about this second technology, about what happens. What is it?
God improves on the design.
God improves on the design. So God gives them clothing 2.0. God upgrades their wardrobe. So, I mean, this is like one of those like theological things you got to stew on. Why would God give them better clothes if the purpose of clothing was to hide themselves from each other? Yeah, Randy.
Because he knows it's a long-term problem.
Okay, knows it's a long-term problem. He's playing the long game. That's good. Dave?
Well, because an animal had to be slaughtered to provide the animal skin for the clothing, so that was the first instance of a blood sacrifice to atone for sin.
That's right. Yeah, there's this theological thread that says that, yeah, that was the first death. And so, whereas their sin should have caused their own death, we see that God killed animals to provide skins for them. And so, you kind of get this idea early on in the story of this substitutionary death. So there is that. That could definitely be part of it. It's a costly upgrade too, right? I mean, clothing 2.0 cost a whole lot more than clothing 1.0. Right? And God could have just said, hey, let me teach you some better stitches and show you where the best leaves are, right? I mean, he could have done it that way, but he chose to kill. You know, this is the first death in the biblical story, which is remarkable. So again, I think there's a lot of, you know, there's no simple answers. Does God love technology or hate technology? Well, you can't really make that kind of decision. Is God for it or against it? And so here you have God upgrading them. All right, let's think about one other one. This first category, we've mostly been thinking about mediated communication between two people. So language is one. Now clothing, I'm going to put that in the same category. This is a way that people communicate between each other. It mediates our relationship, right? And we're all part of a community that believes in that kind of mediation. There are communities that don't, right? There are nudist communities that say, we want unmediated relationships with each other. So that there are different values. But now let's think about the mediated communication of written language, okay? There's a part later in the New Testament that people of that talk about communication and theology and technology are fond to quote. That's 2 John 1:12. So this is an author writing to his audience, and he says this: though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Okay? Paper and ink is, of course, a form of technology. I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face so that our joy may be complete. So it's an interesting thing, because here you have a guy who is using technology to communicate to another group. He's writing to them, and he says, there's a bunch of other stuff I want to say to you, but I don't want to write it. I'd rather say it to you face to face. And you could think of communication as having almost levels of mediation, right? So written communication is more mediated than verbal communication face-to-face, though even verbal communication, we've observed, is still mediated. But maybe we could say it's less mediated, if there's a scale, than written communication. So the author is saying, I'd rather our communication to be less mediated. And then he gives a very specific reason. And he seems to say this kind of communication is superior, so that our joy may be complete, that this kind of experience, a less mediated communication, will result in a more joy, a better experience, a more optimum experience. Now, sometimes people read this verse, and I've seen authors say, this proves that face-to-face communication is better than online communication. Okay? And I think, well, maybe, maybe not, because the author is writing that he wants to see them face to face. So it's not as if he has, you know, for the people that refused to write and only wanted to talk to each other face to face, we don't know anything about them, right? They're probably there in the first century. We just don't know them, and we never will. So it's not that he refused to write, but that he recognized, and I think the better lesson to see here is that certain kinds of interactions are benefited by certain kinds of mediations. Does that sound fair? And that certain kinds of mediations could hurt or help certain kinds of communications. So that there is a bunch of stuff, and in fact, this is John who wrote 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. You know, this is John wrote a bunch. So he clearly felt that writing was a viable form of communication, a viable mediation, and yet there were other kinds of things that he felt required face-to-face. Which, of course, easy answers are a whole lot better, because if we just said, well, face-to-face is better, we could just turn off all of our computers. But if there's these complicated answers, then we have to ask, okay, well, which forms of communication and which kinds of interactions are best served by what kinds of mediations? And that's a lot of thinking to do. Yeah, Jin Cheng.
Kind of like those video chat, like, can't be as face-to-face, although it's online through computer.
That's right. And there are settings where video chat is great, and there are settings where video chat is less than great. So how do you make those kinds of decisions? Yeah, Darren.
And I'm in a couple of different groups that are actually in the process of trying to sort out which, you know, technology would be best for these online communications.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. which chat system, or maybe we don't need a chat system. Maybe we need some sort of a forum.
Right.
Type system, right. Or some sort of a moderated email system, or some sort of a, you know, so there's kind of this, you know, what's the best way to communicate for the purpose we have right now?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Tom.
I think that this is a major problem for society right now. Uh-huh. Right? I mean, why do we have emojis? It's because people cannot communicate, you know, back and forth via written text.
Right.
Without totally misinterpreting what's being said. The tone, I'm going to imply a tone that
wasn't
not
there.
Be there at all.
That's right.
In most cases, probably not, but it's my day's experience. I'm mad because I was on the road or whatever it is, and I put into what they're saying some other tone, you know, and so that in that situation, face-to-face is much better. But I'm also struck by the thought about the debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, right? And so, I don't know if you know the story, but when Kennedy and Nixon debated, the people who watched it on television said Kennedy clearly won.
Right.
But those who heard it only on the radio, it was a landslide that Nixon won. It was because Nixon was not very attractive to look at while he was sweating and all this sort of business, whereas Kennedy was. And so there are certain people who are benefited by not communicating face-to-face.
Absolutely.
And otherwise.
Right,
so I think it really depends. You got to play to your strengths.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. If you've seen some of the presidential portraits, how many of them could be elected in today's media?
Right, right. So if you're not a good-looking politician, you should have lived 100 years ago. It's kind of the takeaway. Yeah.
I haven't thought through this very well, but it seems to me that applying the principles of love the Lord and love your neighbor, that you want your mediated communications to be authentic or have real integrity,
mm-hmm.
or to be whole, or like use some other adjectives. And it seems that some mediated communications are more subject to that abuse of being able to communicate stuff which is not authentic, which is not reality, which is not does not have integrity, which is not real.
That's really good. I think, you know, I haven't put it all together yet, but I think you're hitting on something that even as I'm working through my notes for tonight, keep coming back to, that there's a motivation to reveal or a motivation to conceal, and that all technologies can be used. What's that?
To deceive,
exactly, right. And so, and there are certain forms of mediation, and all mediation allows me to do either of those. But there, some make it easier to do that than others. And so I think you're right. I think that maybe is one of those threads, that regardless of the form, the use of technology that is authentic or integrity, I like that way of thinking, is helpful. You know, my wife and I found, just to think about, the idea that face-to-face is inherently better, we've actually found, even as recently as this week, working through some tension between us, that there are times where non-face-to-face is a whole lot better. You know, and my kids are making fun of us that we're literally sitting at the kitchen table emailing each other because we were talking about something, and it's just better to kind of, you know, I can think through what I want to say, I can say it and deliver it, and it can be received and read and processed and then responded to, versus communication face-to-face sometimes. You know, on occasion, you react emotionally, you stop listening, you interrupt. I've heard other marriages this happens, but, you know. So, there are ways, some mediation actually improves the authenticness and the integrity and the love that you can express. But, of course, some mediation deteriorates that. So how do you feel? Yeah, Tony, you had a thought.
I was going to say that, in terms of technology, if you do it on the Internet, it's two-dimensional. whereas in person it's three-dimensional because you get to see the whole person. Mm-hmm. And then in the case of doubting Thomas, when he heard that Jesus was walking and alive, he said, I have to see his hands and touch it.
That's a great observation, yeah. He wasn't satisfied with the mediated version of the report. He wanted firsthand. Yeah, yeah, that's really good. Okay, we're going to jump forward. So we have three categories of communication between people that we've observed. First is just language in general that was commanded by God. Then we have clothing that was come up with by people and then upgraded by God. And now we have this form of written communication. I want to spend just 5 minutes or so before we break on ways that God mediates his communication to people, because that's actually a big category. And if we think, you know, naively that we don't want any mediation in our communication, then we would do well to look at how God communicates. So first thing, it seems to be that before sin, now we don't actually have a record of this, but it seems to be that God and his people had either an unmediated or a very much lesser mediated relationship between themselves prior to sin. So we read a verse like Genesis 3, verse 8, and we read, "And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day." So that this seems to be, again, we don't have a report of this prior to sin, but it seems to be that this was a pattern, that God would walk in the garden and that Adam and Eve would walk with him and talk with him. And this is where we hear, "And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God." That presumably is a new thing with the introduction of sin. So perhaps before sin there was some, again, either not sure what a completely unmediated relationship with God would look like, but maybe lesser mediated. And now people felt the need to mediate their relationship with God, to run and hide. Does that make sense? Nonetheless, though, then God himself made that choice repeatedly moving forward. So as we look forward to the ways that God communicated with his people, we see that he repeatedly mediates his communication. He uses some type of go-between. So, and in fact, at one point, this is a fascinating story if you think about technology. Exodus 33, verse 18, Moses says to God, "Please show me your glory." Now, in the terms of what we're talking about tonight, you might rephrase that, "Please, God, I want an unmediated experience with you." Okay? Is that a decent paraphrase for our purposes tonight? And what does God say? Says no. Right? You can't handle the truth, right? Right. That's something else. And he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But," he said, "you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live." And so then God does this really tender thing where he puts Moses behind a rock. And he says, "While my glory passes by, I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." So we have Moses wanting an unmediated relationship with God. And God saying, "Yeah, you know, you can't handle it. But I'm going to give you, you know, we're going to go right up to the edge. I'm going to give you as much as you can handle. I'm going to give you my name. I'm going to tell you all about me. I'm going to pass in front of you. I'm going to protect you until the moment where you can see me safely." And so you see God, I think, wanting the same thing, wanting a less mediated communication with his servant and doing everything he can to minimize the mediation in that encounter. Now, so there's this tension even between God and man of how much mediation is helpful versus how much is hurtful. Well, God does something else interesting too. When he communicates more en masse to his people, he does this. Exodus 24, verse 12. The Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and wait there that I may give you the tablets of stone. Somebody mentioned tablets as one of the pieces of technology, right? Tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I've written for their instruction. One of the authors I was reading pointed out that tablet technology in Egypt had kind of arrived at just the right time for Moses to make use of it so that God could give his people his law, which formed the basis of his character to them in a way that was way more permanent and repeatable than anything they had before, which would have been just oral tradition, right?
If it hadn't been for the apple, they wouldn't have needed the tablet.
That's true. That sounds like a joke there. Well done. Now, this is interesting, actually, the kind of history of tablet technology, speaking of these kinds of stone tablets. Tablets actually had been developing for about 1,000 years at this point. They found the first tablets around 3300 BC, if you trust the dating. Can anybody guess? I don't think you'll guess this, but what was the first recorded tablet writing? These were cuneiform clay tablets that had been discovered. What was being recorded on these tablets? It wasn't the Rosetta Stone, no.
Some kind of accounting?
It was accounting, yes.
It was a complaint about receiving a lower grade of materials.
Almost all of early writing was accounting. But what were they accounting of?
Shopping lists of materials.
Not quite.
Census.
Animals.
Not animals, something way more valuable.
Dimensions.
Beer. The very first accounting was a list of the daily beer rations for workers to make sure that the accounting was that workers were given the proper beer rations for the work they put in. So, anyway, that tidbit was free tonight. You can use that at a party. All right, so we have God mediating between people, and we have this technology that God chooses to use, which if we think about it. You know, and it's easy to say that God made a good decision because he does, but this was a great decision, right? if we think about this kind of question we've been asking, what is the right kind of mediated communication for the right occasion? A tablet of stone to record his law that could be carried around, that could last. This is it. This is a great use of technology. And so God took advantage of the technology available to the culture, used it in a way that served his interests perfectly, and preserved something long term. So if we think about other ways that God mediated his communication, think about the prophets, think even if you're in the service this morning about Ezekiel, right? Visions themselves are mediated forms of communication. There's something deep being communicated by imagery and by prophecy and by signs. And so there's a way to communicate that. And in fact, the scriptures as a whole are a form of mediated communication. And I think it's interesting to think about it this way. Think about all of the confusion that we have about the scriptures. Now, God could pretty easily show up every couple years and say, it really was six literal days, and, you know, I don't like beer, you shouldn't be drinking it, and dancing's okay, but as long as you're not touching, and, you know, I mean, God could kind of show up every now and then and just clarify everything that people have been asking about, and then things would be a whole lot easier, right? Like, there's a whole lot of ambiguity in the way that God has chosen to communicate to us that God is certainly capable of removing all that ambiguity. So then I think it's fair to ask, if God does make good decisions, why does he mediate his communication to us in a way that leaves so much ambiguity? And you know, spoiler alert, there's probably a good reason. It's probably serves his purposes somehow that his communication is mediated in the way that it has been. So what are those purposes? I don't know.
Faith?
Yeah?
I mean, Jesus, you know, the disciples basically said, man, why don't you explain things so people can understand them? He said, I don't want everybody to understand them.
That's right.
So I think that's I think that's probably a big part of it.
That could, yeah. Then you have the like revealing and hiding aspects again. That actually God's mediation reveal, and in fact Jesus spoke as much, right? So that though, so that some could see and some could not see. That's interesting.
I mean, if you count all the hours people have studied the Bible,
that's true.
And that is all for their good.
Okay, right.
I mean, we have to dive in there and think and process and study. And if he had said, "Here's what I really mean," the end of story.
Right.
What would we do with all our time?
More video games, right?
Right. We'd be out of a job.
That's right. Yeah, what would I do? Yeah, Darren, and then we'll take a break.
One of the difficulties working with junior high, high school age boys is just sometimes getting them to really talk, especially more than the pat answers. You know, pray, read the Bible, go to church.
Right.
Pray, read the Bible, go to church. Doesn't matter what the question is. But one of the times that we actually saw it happening was a conversation about whether Christians should play video games.
Okay.
And you know, because there aren't hard answers, you know, yes, they're good, no, they're not, they could actually have an interesting conversation.
That is great. Yeah, I like that.
So, could you say that God does speak to us in this present day? For instance, like, we just had that eclipse. Mm. Is that, you know, God speaking to us, in a sense, by controlling nature and the forces of nature?
Certainly a demonstration of God's power and creativity and beauty. So one last thought, just to kind of send us into break with, the scriptures themselves then are a kind of technology, right? Because they extend God's communication to us. And so that's a technology. And you could even say then that the incarnation itself is a kind of technological innovation, right? Jesus is fully God, fully man. That's a kind of technology that God used. And in this case, if we think about our reveal hide fault line, God used the incarnation to reveal himself to his creation. Let's chew on that for a minute. Let's take maybe a 5-10 minute break. We'll come back. Stretch break. There's some cookies and snacks over there. Bathroom. There's some hot water, coffee, tea, etc. So we'll come back about 8:15, 8:20, and we will wrap up for good exactly at 9. All right, what we're going to do with the last part of tonight is start the process. You know, there's a whole lot more thinking. I mean, we could do a whole class, and maybe we will, on biblical technology, you know, the technology in the Bible. There's dozens of more things we could look at and talk about. And I think probably those kinds of things are worthwhile, to think about the kinds of technology that we see in the Bible, the kinds of decisions that were made around those technologies, and who was making them, and whether they were good or bad. And but based on the little bit of a glimpse we've had so far, we're going to just start the process of applying that to today and think about what that means. So what I want to do in the beginning is to think a little bit about the idea that technologies inherently involve values, and those values can be either explicit or implicit. So that typically you create a technology for a purpose or to solve a problem. If we go back to the kind of process that Adam and Eve went through, right? Their eyes were open, they saw they were naked, they sewed fig leaves together, and they made loincloths. This is the process. Typically, you create technology to do something or to solve some problem, but as a consequence, often the technology you create has other implications, has other consequences that perhaps you didn't anticipate. And so there's two factors at work here that we want to be thinking about. One is that technology has unintended consequences. So can we think well about those? And two is that technologies, by their very nature, almost, this is an overstatement, this is kind of a personification of technology, but they almost beg to be used, right? So that if I, you know, if I had put hammers on all of these tables, when you walked in the room, some of you, the ones that were more, had more kind of junior high boy in you, would have picked them up and started hitting things with them. Fair enough? And if I'd put that in the youth room, we wouldn't have need to pay for demo, right, for our remodel. I mean, technologies by their existence kind of beg to be used, and then when technologies are used, those values that they were created for are absorbed in a sense, right? So that I might not be an inherently violent person, but if I walk into a room full of hammers day after day after day and find myself swinging hammers day after day, I will absorb some of the values of those things. Not that hammering is violent, but you know, kind of get where I'm going. That technologies by their creation. So, you know, most people in this room probably have an iPhone or a smartphone or something, and it's not that you kind of independently woke up one morning and said, "This, I really need this tool in my life for these purposes to solve these problems." You know, this is just the world we live in. You get this kind of a tool, and so you use this kind of a tool, and this kind of a tool shapes you in some way. Yeah, Christine.
So I am a little confused about the term value.
Okay.
I feel more like meaning purpose.
We'll get there in a minute. Okay. I'll explain values.
Because I think there probably is technology that's valueless.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Most value on it, but it yep. actually doesn't have.
For your, yeah, you might think, you know, value compared to purpose, I'm going a little bit more abstract. So like Adam and Eve created clothes because they valued privacy or something. And so privacy is a value, or concealing is a value, that kind of thing. Does that make sense? I think it'll make more. We're going to brainstorm on values in a minute. But first, yeah, Darren.
Well, one thing that your hammer suggest, your mm-hmm. hammer concept makes me think is, If you you know, everybody walks in the room, there's hammers on all the tables, mm-hmm. you'll get a certain result.
Right.
Everybody walks in the room and there are saws on all the tables, you'll actually get a pretty similar result.
Okay.
You walk into a room and there are both hammers and saws,
oh, interesting.
You might get something rather different.
Sure, yeah. And that's part of what, yeah, the very presence of technology shapes you, and so technological choices give you options, but if one thing is always present, you tend towards using it. So let's do a little activity in our tables. What I want you to do is, around your table group, I want you to brainstorm some piece of technology that had an unintended consequence. And then we're gonna share that together as a group, okay? So your job is to come up with one piece of technology that was created for one purpose, ended up having an unintended consequence. All right? You got like 3 minutes.
Well, if we had something nobody else had, that would be better.
Took away all the public horse trough because they were spreading the disease, and then it was no longer practical to have.
Because
they didn't have ready water. Maybe I'm trying to remember what the connection is.
Yes.
Would be steam power.
Yeah, steam power. I don't know about electric.
Unless
you're consuming, it would have been steam.
It would have been steam.
All right, one more minute.
It's not desirable.
All right, let's come together. Let's bring it back together as a group. All right, so what did you guys come up with? Which table wants to share? Technology with unintended consequence. Yeah, and Tom?
Yeah, so smartphones.
Okay.
You know, they seem, they're very alluring, right?
Indeed.
All of us have them, and they are wonderful tools in so many ways, but there are probably just as many unintended consequences of smartphones as there are benefits to them. If you think about it, breakdown in communication that we've talked about, inability to communicate face-to-face, inability to know how to read other people, the breakdown in social mores, things that you say and you keep to yourself, that sort of thing. Increases in pornography use as a direct result, because now people can get it on their phone and they don't have, nobody else knows. They don't go to the 7-Eleven and buy it or whatever it is, and that sort of thing. And then sex trafficking increases as a result, because some people are going to be captured and made into, you know, the objects of this pornography that's being sold. And so there's so many unintended, you know, dastardly consequences.
Great vocab word. It's good. Agreed, yeah. Yeah, what else? Yeah, that's good. Christine?
Well, we weren't sure that you meant negative.
Okay. I'm not sure what I meant either.
Notes.
So, post-it notes, okay?
So the glue that was invented, the guy thought he failed.
Okay.
Right? He was trying to invent a new kind of glue, and it would stick, but it wouldn't, you know, you could just peel it right off, and then somebody else said, you know, we could use that for...
Okay, good. All right, good.
That's a huge thing.
I love post-it notes. I agree.
No, we don't love them.
Not dastardly at all. I'm not sure you could find a bad use for post-it. I'm sure you could. Thank you. Yeah. What else?
We also had off-label drug usage.
Off-label drug usage.
For one purpose is discovered to be useful for something completely different.
Oh, good. Okay, right.
That's on the positive side.
Yeah, yeah. Good. This is the optimistic table, yeah.
How about GPS?
GPS?
GPS was developed by the military to tell where things were and what time it was exactly. Now we've got Waze, Google Maps, and, you know, 5,000 startups.
Yeah.
And others using GPS.
People That's finding good. Tupperware in the woods.
Good. All right. Any other tables want to share?
I think we talked about like opiates or opioids, you know, those medicines that were there to be great painkillers, but have consequences around addiction as well as, you know, the entire drug industry, if you will. The underworld industry is what I was referring to there.
Okay, good, yeah, right.
So our table mentioned a lot of those opioids and things like that, but I mentioned E=MC² because I don't know why Einstein was trying to harness his energy, but instead we use it for other things.
Like putting on T-shirts and stuff? It's good, yeah.
The nuclear arsenals.
Nuclear arsenals, right.
so yeah. much waste sitting around everywhere. Yeah. And everybody wants to get a handle on it.
Yeah. What about you guys? You guys have anything?
The internet.
The internet. Way to go broad. That's good. Yeah.
We'll have summaries. Other people will touch on the topic.
Good. Okay. Well, good. This is a kind of a primer. Get us thinking along these lines of values. So we're going to return to this. And here's the big idea, is that certain tools, so we've already said that tools ask to be used, right? And now we want to suggest that tools promote values. And so it's kind of like the phrase, you know, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So the values for which a tool, those things that a tool helps you to do, the capabilities it helps to extend, the things it augments within you, those become promoted within you. So and where we're going to kind of go with this is this idea that there are explicit values that we create things. So, for instance, opioids, right? We value health. We value lack of pain. We value comfort, right? So we create this thing that helps those things, that is a legitimate benefit to medical practice, that makes people more comfortable and decreases pain. But then those values have with it the implicit value or the unintended value of escape, right? Of removal that can lead to addiction. And so you create something with explicit values, but the tools you create always have multiple layers of values. And you end up promoting the implicit values as well. I know that's a little bit hard to grasp, but we're going to flesh this out together. So let's, and in fact, if you want to start in a book, you'll recognize a lot of the kind of the things we're saying about the biblical stuff, but this book, From the Garden to the City by John Dyer, is a great book. It's actually, you know, it's dated now because it's like 6 years old or something. So it's like basically, you know, irrelevant to our contemporary society. I do recommend him. One of the things he kind of walks through his narrative, and he says that one of his professors told him that, you know, he always kind of had this idea that technology was neutral, but that it was how you used it that mattered. And one of his professors said, technology is never neutral. And this is this thing that like kept him up at night, and it kind of forms a little bit of a story of this book. And he basically concludes that the professor was right, that technology is not neutral. That technology always imbues values, and you need to understand what values it is. So I'll leave you to chew on that. But let's think about this. We're going to make two lists, all right? For those of you that know me well, you know I love whiteboards, one of my favorite technologies. So I've been dying not to use it yet. So we're going to think about explicit values that we as a society value, and that we... you know, if you think about the business plans that are likely to get funding, what are the values that they're promoting, or the technologies that we use, the things that sell, what are the values that promoting? So what are some of the explicit values in our
society? Financial profit.
Financial profit. Okay, we like profit. I like that. Good.
Fun.
How about mobility?
Mobility.
Utility.
Health. Oh.
Convenience.
Fame.
What was the last one?
Fame.
Yeah.
Organization. Efficiency.
Yes, yeah, we totally value efficiency.
Speed.
Comfort.
Ease.
Style.
You guys are good at this.
It's because you are writing.
Novelty. Novelty.
Novelty. That's a good one.
Curiosity.
Curiosity. Mm-hmm.
privacy.
Security.
Scale?
That's a business
thing. Okay.
Yeah. Scale.
How about sense of community?
Community, yeah. Pretty good list. Anything else?
Hacking?
All right. You value hacking?
This kind of goes with community, but like the social aspect.
Yeah.
I don't know how to...
Like connection maybe? Or
yeah.
Social connection? Yeah.
Autonomy?
Ooh, yeah, that's good. All right, so that's a good list. This wasn't what I was thinking of, but we might... No. The list is what I was thinking of, but as you make this list, I'm starting to wonder, so are these, you know, from a Christian perspective, from a biblical, from a theological perspective, are these good values or bad values? It depends on their use, their ideal values. Yeah, so some of them, right, I'm trying to think, could we make a case that all of them, I mean, are any of them black or white? Are any of them purely bad or purely good, or all of them, I mean, you could say, well, comfort, I mean, comfort can be good. It's too much comfort can be bad, but...
But not
if someone else. So they're all a little bit complicated, right? Values are complicated. Values, we probably could if we tried to find a value that is purely anti-biblical or against
community
God.
Is a pretty good one.
What's that?
True community.
So that's pretty much all good. Yeah, I like that.
Unless you're a sect in Texas.
Unless you're a cult, right? Then who you have community with. That's right. Okay, so now what we want to do is try to think about some technologies that have been created in order to kind of promote these values, one of these values, and think about maybe an implicit value that happened along with it. So I'll give you an example to help you along. So one of them might be this communication, right? Communication accessibility maybe is one of our values, right? And so we have smartphones. So now, you know, I rarely go anywhere without this, right? A lot of you are the same way. You would rarely go anywhere without this. But then I'm at lunch, and it used to be the case that, right, if I were at lunch and you needed to contact me, maybe if it were a family emergency, you'd call the restaurant and some waiter would, hey, is there a Paul here, right? I mean, like... But now, do you like this TV show? You'll text me, and I'm supposed to respond, even though I'm having lunch with my friend, right? So the value of accessibility came with an implicit value of interruptibility, right? So that I'm more accessible than I ever have been, but I'm also more interruptible than I ever have been. So that's kind of one of these classic... implicit, explicit values. And so I'm not sure that anybody would say, I really value interruptibility. You know, I just want anything I'm doing to be able to be interrupted at any moment. That's really important to me. And yet, we as a culture value interruptibility based on our actions. Is that fair to say?
Yours, not mine.
Yours, that's right. Exactly. Okay, so what are some other implicit values that perhaps our tools shape us towards?
Isolation,
yeah. Flush that out. Why?
Well, you can see people sitting at the same restaurant where you're being interrupted.
Uh-huh.
And they're all on their phones.
Uh-huh.
They're not even talking to each other anymore.
Right.
It makes me so sad.
Yeah. So, yeah, a tool that helps connect me to people can also have this other implicit value of isolating me from people. Yeah.
There's a group that we get together with for dinner sometimes. One of the dynamics that we've noticed is there are certain types of conversations that don't happen anymore because someone will whip out the internet in their pocket and look it up.
Okay.
So instead of us discussing, well, what if it was this way, what if it was that way, they've got the answer right on Wikipedia.
Right.
And so you don't...
Information over
curiosity.
Curiosity, yeah. Or not, or like... verifiability, right? You can't ever wonder anything.
and the point of the conversation isn't necessarily even to nail down an answer. It's right. To interact with people. But
I'm going to call that ex-curiosity.
Even non-privacy. I mean, privacy is a value, but non-privacy is what we all accept by
these
things. Openness.
Apparently, we're fine with it.
Yeah.
Everything's public, where it didn't used to be.
Right.
Depression?
Depression?
Yeah.
How so?
People are just isolated. There's no one. Yeah.
Reading about how everybody else has got a great life on Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah, so comparison maybe, right?
Well, and everybody's only posting, you know, the good stuff, so you give this facade that is misleading.
Well, that's the conceit of that we all carry on, right?
Positive presentation, right?
We're good.
Conformity,
yeah.
I mean, it's really... explicitly, there's sort of this embracing of diversity. Unless it's your kind of diversity.
That's right. And there's a lot of talking about this lately, the kind of echo chamber effect of diversity, but gets kind of coalesced into pockets of, yeah.
Shallowness in relationships?
What's that?
Shallowness?
Shallowness, yeah. Yeah. So I think some of the ways that this might start to play out, if we were to try to draw some kind of conclusions or some type of, well, what do we do with all this thinking we've done tonight, is that either to be aware that as you're creating or using technology for a specific value, be aware that there are implicit values. That's one thing, awareness. I would say to predict, but I'm not sure I'm all that confident that we can predict the unintended consequences. So then maybe it's not so much about predicting, but about responding to, right? Because, you know, I'm going to create this thing. Whoever created the smartphone didn't think, oh, it's going to result in sex trafficking. So how can I engineer it so the way it doesn't do that? I mean, maybe they could have anticipated that. But they probably could have anticipated every possible implicit value. So how do we respond to those things? And so maybe this is a bit of an iterative cycle too, right? It's kind of where theology comes into technology, there's some type of refining process and a shaping that goes along with it. So what happens then is that technologies themselves become tools to do something, but then the technologies themselves begin shaping culture. And there's been a fair amount of thinking along those lines in the last several decades about how technology forms and shapes a culture along these lines, and how technologies, by their very existence, ends up changing the way we even interact with each other and the way we think about things. So there's a bit of a just a touch on that subject, and I want to talk about one more kind of categories of things that we can think about, specifically thinking about biblical theology and technology. But before we get there, any other comments about this or thoughts about that? Explicit or implicit? Yeah, Tony.
I was just thinking, could you also say that technology is sometimes prophetic in a sense?
Mm.
Because, you know, it enhances our lives. But Isn't that what God wants of us to do, is to enhance our lives? And so we're just trying to get truth revealed to us and what God wants for us. So that's, I don't know, I guess I'm trying to say, you know, is it prophetic in a sense?
Yeah. I think it can be, yeah. I mean, it's, and again, we're not trying to say technology is wrong or bad or stay away. I mean, this is not, there are cautions, but it's not a, it's not kind of new technologies destroy things, but how can we, with biblical reflection and biblical theology, respond well to the changing technology in our world? There's one more thought, maybe. I thought I saw a hand. So then let me give us a few more ideas and then we're going to wrap up. Thinking specifically about theology and some of the ways that our technology today can lead us down false paths of theology. And so I want to suggest two lists of three of dangers and opportunities. I'm going to move to my second whiteboard. I was prepared tonight, knowing that I would exhaust one. So one of the dangers of technology today is a ancient, we're going to say dangers and opportunities, an ancient theological error that goes by the term Gnosticism. All right, so who wants to try to define Gnosticism for us?
Only people that have the secret knowledge
have the
path to God.
Mm-hmm. Secret knowledge, yep. People have the secret knowledge, have this path to God. It's almost this like knowledge-based enlightenment thing. And one of the characteristics of Gnosticism was that it elevated the immaterial above the material. And so Gnosticism has actually plagued society and theology and churches for millennia, literally. But the idea is that the spiritual or the immaterial is better or more real or more fuller than the material. So there's a degrading of the material body. And there's, you know, even 50 years ago, there's all sorts of books about how even the church needs to regain kind of a body theology to understand the importance of physicality and stuff like this. But with the advent of some of our types of mediated communication, it would serve us well to think about how Gnosticism can re-enter so that, you know, who I am online becomes maybe a more fuller sense of who I really am. This is where I'm able to be myself. This is where I'm able to be open. And so what we see is this kind of divorcing of physical and immaterial, and an elevation then of the immaterial above the physical. And what proper theology, there is a marrying of the two. I've already said that it's not that face-to-face is always better, the physical is always better. There is a combination of the two that exists well together. This is why God came in the flesh, right? But the Gnostics would say that Jesus wasn't really flesh, because flesh is icky. Right, Jesus was spirit because spirit is superior. But we could have that same conversation today. Replace spirit with virtual or online, and you get the same exact patterns of thinking. Yeah, Eric.
I was going to say one of the leading venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road has a central investment thesis: the dematerialization of value.
Of what?
Of value.
There you go.
That's his central thesis for investing.
That's great. And so we might, you know, that should ring some bells if we have any theological kind of, oh, wait, that's Gnosticism embodied in technological progress. So that's really good. Now, again, it's not that we don't value the immaterial at all, but that how do we keep that balance? How do we keep those things married well? Now, on the flip side, what some of those same things that contend towards Gnosticism have done is they've made knowledge accessible in ways that it never has been before, right? so that I can be at lunch with a friend and wonder, what was the capital of, you know, whatever, I don't know. And I can look it up and I can know. I don't even know my geography enough to know what to ask, right? I'd have to pull up Google Maps and find a country name to know what to ask about. But knowledge, even biblical knowledge, even lots of kinds of knowledge, is accessible to people in ways that it never would have been. And that's one of the kind of things that have happened along history, is that from oral transmission to the printing press to the telegraph, just knowledge, you know, what happens here tonight, you guys will probably all be tweeting about this all night, right? And pretty soon it'll be viral and everybody will be wondering about, I mean, this is what can happen in our culture. So we might say, well, that's a really good thing, right? I mean, we want knowledge to be accessible. We want things to go forth. But then as knowledge is accessible and as the immaterial is easier to transmit, do we have to worry about this? So how do we keep those things in check? I'm going to go through two more. I'm just thinking about them briefly. Second one is isolationism. And this was brought up over here. So this is a fascinating one because there's more and more stuff being done just thinking about online interactions and communities and so much more social interaction that's happening, and yet there's a sense of isolationism. And I think one of the aspects here is that and it has to do with some of the kind of communal versus individual stuff that's happened in Western culture, but we now view ourselves like, you know, if I were to go to a room with some cocktails and appetizers and chat with people, what would I be doing?
Networking,
right? And so if, you know, you and I met tonight and I Facebook friend you, now you're part of my social
network,
right? Or maybe I, you know, this pastor thing isn't working out, so I want to have a job at your company, so I might be part of your professional
network,
right? So our communities are now networks. But what are networks? Network is an abstraction, but it is nodes loosely connected by lines, right? So now I'm a node. And so I'm a single dot, but I'm connected to you with, and the line's pretty long in most networks, right? So there's this sense of, so it's almost like connection and isolationism almost go together. It's like the more connected I am, the more isolated I am, which is some weird irony. But imagining myself as a network versus, you know, the difference maybe between a network and a community. What's a community? A community, it's not, you know, nodes of people connected. It's a group that's all interconnected. If you were to draw that as a network, it'd be just a tangle. But so, are we networks? You know, are our churches networks of people, or are they communities of people? So this isolationism is a danger that's, again, always been a danger throughout history. None of these things are new. It's not as if, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. It's not as if technology is introducing new challenges. The human heart has always been sinful. There's always been brokenness in the world. The same bad things will always happen. But technology introduces new ways that those same bad things happen. So isolationism, and yet there is connection. I mean, I just kind of argued against thinking about ourselves as networks, but the idea of connection between people is probably a good thing in general, right? We want to be connected. We want to know each other across distances, across cultures, across time even, ethnicities, whatever. So again, good and bad, how do we balance those? And the last one I want us to think about is self-identity. So one of the things that we are taught by our culture and by the tools that we have, so some of these implicit values, I think a big one that comes up is the idea that my self-identity is my responsibility. And I think one of the just dominant messages in our culture, you know, the idea of creation has been a challenge for the last 100 years in Christianity. But there's a new version of creation that is a new challenge, and that is the idea that I create myself. So I create my persona online. I create my social network. There's this burden, and it is a crushing burden of self-creation that is just, it's explicit, right? I mean, you talk about the VC model. This is what you're taught now in schools. Like, your job is to create your brand. This is what you have to do to survive as a young professional. You have to create your brand. You have to create yourself. You have to create some persona that is, doesn't even matter if it is really you. You just have to create something that is you. And yet, we know, theologically, from a Christian perspective, God creates us. And so that's an immense truth, and it's really hard to fight against. And so all of these things teach us to create ourselves, and that is dangerous and crushing and isolating and depressing and all sorts of bad things when the burden is on us to create ourselves. And yet, some of those same technologies, I would say, allow us to express ourselves in really great ways. So that now I have access to people's thoughts and creativity and art and music that I would never have access to because of the accessibility of their work and the tools they have to express themselves. But then we're back to that, one of those similar questions, right? When does self-expression become self-creation? When am I authentically revealing myself through a new medium that has given me tools to express something God has given me? And when am I forced to try and create a persona that conforms to something I think I need to look like or be like or seem like? I don't know. So these are the kinds of things I think that we can be thinking through. So I want to wrap up just by kind of returning to our guiding principles and highlighting those that God created us. Our original creation mandate was to create and control. So we need to be doing that. We should be creating technology, I think. I think we as the church can have a message to our culture that we love creating technology. There is nothing wrong with that. God has always been doing it. And yet, we want to create technology well that helps to fulfill how God has shaped our actions, which is to love God and love people. And so how do we create and control in ways that love God and love people? That's the big umbrella. And scratching the surface is too generous for what we've done tonight. there is so much to think about and process and little, decisions and stuff like that. So if you're interested in kind of continuing the conversation, please do fill out the survey, tinyurl.com/techtheo. Actually, even if you're not interested, I'd love for more feedback. Thoughts about tonight, like I said, I kind of came here tonight with some loosely scattered thoughts, and I have no idea whether this was useful or not, or totally random. So I'd love your feedback about how this fits together or what parts you thought were more interesting or not. And keep your eye out. There is a space for name and email there. I'll kind of start an informal list and let you know about other things that we're doing. So let me just close this in prayer, and we'll be done. God, I'm grateful for your guidance for us, grateful for your word that helps to reveal who you are and how we are to be your people. So I pray you'd be helping us in this area to be faithful and to be users and creators of technology for the sake of your kingdom. We need a lot of help in that, so I pray that you give us each other, that you give us space and time and the right opportunities to learn and grow, and that you'd help us to represent you well to the world. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. All right, thanks everyone.